and welcome to the Giving Voice to Depression podcast. I'm Terry, the creator and co-host of this podcast. I've lived with depression most of my life, and I know how easy it can be to feel all alone in the experience. I'm not alone, and you aren't either.
And I'm Dr. Anita Sands, a licensed clinical psychologist with a number of my own diagnoses, all of which bring a certain amount of anxiety and depression along with them. There is great power in shared experiences. We share our own as we engage in intimate and candid conversations with our weekly guests, exploring different perspectives on and experiences with depression.
We keep it real because depression is real. We keep it hopeful because there truly is hope in spite of what depression tells you.
Hi, Terry.
Hello, Anita. So we are excited to announce a new partnership, which will allow us to continue producing our podcast and creating our daily mental health social media posts. Rehab Path, through its website, recovery.com, provides resources and information for individuals seeking treatment for mental health or addiction issues. It offers a fact-checked and vetted online platform of treatment centers to help individuals find the right path to recovery.
This episode is the last of a four-episode series looking first at specific ways, both big and smaller, that those of us with mental health struggles can reach out for support when we need it, even when it's hard to do. That's what episodes 299 and 300 were about. The second half of that equation, which is this and last week's focus, is specific, meaningful ways that we can offer support to someone who is struggling, even if they've not asked for it, which again is a very real obstacle for many people. We cannot let the fact that we don't know exactly what to do or what to say or how to approach the person stop us from doing something. And this episode will give you some more specific ways that have provided comfort and help to our return guest, Sam Dylan Finch. He has compiled a list of 11 things his loved ones have done for him that made a difference. We dove into the first five suggestions last week in an episode we'll link to with this. Here now is Sam giving his voice to depression.
We resume our discussion with the sixth helpful and respectful way people have supported Sam when he needed it. They did not lecture him about what treatment was best.
I have yet to meet someone with mental illness who hasn't had some kind of complaint around this. Mm-hmm. I think everyone likes to think they know what's best for someone.
And it's usually yoga?
It's almost always yoga.
Yeah, I think so too.
It's almost always yoga or like meditation or things that are like certainly helpful, but they're not the be-all, end-all, and they're not right for everyone.
Right.
So I think folks have an over-reliance of telling people to essentially, you know, pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And then they have a tendency to criticize things that we actually know from clinical research is very helpful for some folks. So things like medication and therapy. Mm-hmm. And it's weird that we put such an overemphasis on stuff that requires you to be mentally healthy in order to be able to really do it.
Yeah.
And then we criticize the stuff that exists for folks who just don't have a healthy enough baseline to be able to really participate in life. Because in all honesty, no matter how well you know someone, you don't know what their capacity is for participating in some of the things that you're recommending. Unsolicited advice can just be really frustrating, even if it's great advice. Folks may just not be in a position where they want to hear that at that point.
And more often than not, it's not our first episode or whatever word we want to use. And, you know, asking us what has worked in the past can be a lot more useful than telling us what you think will work in the present.
Absolutely. The redundancy of the advice that we get is frustrating because it's not our first rodeo. Like, we've been through this more than likely multiple times before. And given the fact that the age of onset for mental illness is often really young, most of us have had lots of experience dealing with these things.
The seventh way Sam's support system really comes through for him, and we can do to come through for someone we care about, is help them navigate the mental health system.
You would be hard-pressed to find a person with some kind of mental health challenge that's not frustrated with the mental health system, even under the best of circumstances, because it's complicated and messy and really difficult to navigate. I think that there are folks who don't have experience with this who think that once you realize you have a mental health problem, you just go and get a therapist or you go and get a psychiatrist and bada bing, like 2 weeks later, you emerge and you're totally fine. And it's just not at all like that. There are delays. There are tons of phone calls you often have to make. You have to deal with insurance, which is notoriously awful to deal with, assuming you even have insurance. And if you don't, you have to find services that will still help you. It's a mess. And I think that if you're already in a difficult place, the idea of having to dig through that mess is just awful.
Help can look like sharing the name of a good therapist or doctor you or someone you know is working with, going on the internet to research which providers take your friend's insurance, picking up their prescription, making the calls to see if a psychiatrist or medical doctor is taking new patients, or scheduling an appointment and driving them to it. If an emergency room visit is necessary, go with the person and be their advocate.
And it was essential for me, too, as someone who often appears to be quote-unquote high-functioning, to have people in the emergency room with me, because oftentimes the nurses and doctors that I interacted with, even the social workers, seemed to think I was a lot better than I actually was. So I was not always my best advocate in those situations. So having loved ones there who were able to say, no, you know, I have been staying in his apartment the last 2 days, and I am afraid to leave him alone, like, that can be the difference between getting the care that you need and being sent home. Because so often, if they suspect that you're not quote-unquote sick enough, they're very reluctant to admit you. And with mental health especially, you never know who you're going to be interacting with and what kind of attitudes they have towards folks with mental illness. Mm-hmm. And that just adds a whole other layer of fear to it.
Number 8 on the list is that Sam's support team worked hard to keep his trust, even when they didn't approve of his choices.
Yeah, so this one is tricky, I recognize, because it's getting into kind of murky territory that I think makes people uncomfortable, but I still think it's important to talk about. The example that I include is substance abuse.
Depressive disorders often cause acutely uncomfortable feelings, such as overwhelming sadness, hopelessness, and isolation. And it's very common for people to self-medicate.
The predicament that it introduces if you criticize someone for making those choices or you judge them too harshly, they're more likely to isolate themselves. It's not likely to get them to change their behavior that's dangerous. It's just more likely to get them to reject support. And that becomes dangerous in the sense that if someone's abusing substances but they no longer feel that they can reach out to anyone when they're in that frame of mind, it could lead to a really tragic situation where there could be an overdose involved, or there could be some kind of dangerous circumstance where they're somewhere by themselves and they can't get home. It just introduces a lot of scenarios that are really dangerous.
Sam offers some responses that leave the door open. They are context dependent, he says, and include, do you have a plan for what you'll do differently next time you're feeling this way? Can I help you come up with one?
More often than not, risk-taking is accompanied by impulsivity. And oftentimes, we have a tendency to romanticize the choice because we think about what it immediately gives us instead of the long-term consequences. So for me and drinking, it was like, well, when I started drinking, I felt better. Mm-hmm. But then I didn't really stop drinking, and then there were consequences. But in my mind, I could only really think about the initial feeling I had of feeling better, and that was all that I wanted in that moment. But when you're able to engage in those conversations and look at the bigger picture and start to unpack the patterns and what other options exist for you in those moments, it's progress, right? It's not always going to fix things immediately, and oftentimes when you talk about things like substance abuse, it's a long-term process. But you start to realize that there are other paths you can take in the long term to start to deal with these behaviors, and that you're not, you know, without options in any of the situations that you've been assuming that you were.
Another constructive comment is, I am not here to judge you. I just want to figure out how to keep you safe.
Just emphasizing that there's no judgment is so important, because we're already judging ourselves, guaranteed. We are already judging ourselves, especially if there were consequences involved, especially if we hurt someone in the process.
A third question to maintain both trust and safety is, if there's a next time, can you give me a list of three people you'll contact before you act?
And it doesn't mean that I would call that person and say, I really want to get drunk. It's just having that connection. Sometimes keeping yourself safe isn't always about opening up about what you're feeling. It's just about delaying behaviors that could be really toxic. So if it buys you some amount of time, that's still really valuable. It gives you more time to think through what those options might be, or to just let those feelings pass over you, which is so often what we have to do when we have those impulses, because they're very hardwired more often than not, especially when you talk about something like substance abuse.
Number 9 on Sam's list of 11 important ways he's been successfully supported through a mental health crisis is that his loved ones kept checking in with him, even when he seemed better.
I think in general, appearances can be deceiving. I know for myself, when I start to feel like I'm putting too much of a burden on someone, I might not be so forthcoming about when I start to get depressed again, because I might feel that I have exhausted my resources. And so I'm less likely to share, you know, it's happening again. Or I might just feel ashamed. I think a lot of people, when they do start to feel better and then things get worse again, it can feel like a personal failure. It can feel like, oh, I thought I had it figured out and now I'm doing worse again. And I might be reluctant to admit and throw medications into the mix, and it becomes even more complicated because we know that medications can change things really quickly and in unexpected ways. So there's really no reliable way to know for sure that someone has improved in the ways that you might assume without checking in with them and really asking them how they're doing, regardless of how they appear to be doing.
There is also the heartbreaking fact that a sudden feeling of calm or even happiness can be a sign a person has made a plan to end their suffering. Sam addresses that more in his article, to which we will link. Number 10 on his list makes the distinction between a support person needing to take a break and doing what feels like abandonment to the friend in need.
And I do think there's a way in most situations to step back from offering support to someone that will not have nearly the devastating impact that simply disappearing can have on someone.
Some suggestions for how to accomplish that include saying,
my life is getting a little bit hectic right now. I'm not sure how reliable I'll be in the next couple of weeks. What other forms of support do you have in place? Again, whenever possible, if you're going to step back, it's important to make sure there's support in place, that you're not the only person that was that person's support. Because even though it's not your fault that you've been positioned as this like solo savior, that means it's kind of a dangerous situation.
Sam lists several other ways to approach the discussion. But again, the goal is to take the break you need as a caregiver, to recharge and take care of your own stuff, while making clear to the person who's struggling that you still care and are not disappearing.
But it can be as simple as saying, you know, this isn't a reflection at all about how much I care about you, but I'm running low on energy. I want to make sure you're okay, though. Who else is supporting you? It really does make a difference so that that person knows that that support is still there. It's just not immediately available in the way that it was before. And that really is a significant difference, because it's the difference between losing a point of contact for an amount of time versus feeling like you've lost someone in your life.
Number 11, another important way to offer support to someone in a mental health crisis, is not to wait for them to ask for help.
I really wish that more people felt empowered to just check in with people just because. You don't have to wait for some kind of like red flag to be lifted. You don't have to wait for someone to cry out for help in a way that's obvious, because so often people don't. Vulnerability is hard in and of itself, and then magnify that with some kind of stigmatized mental health condition, and you will find more often than not that people are very reluctant to ask for help.
But since you are listening to this, you obviously care and want to help. You're trying to learn like we are. And we can all be part of changing the dynamic and breaking the stigma. Start anywhere. If someone seems withdrawn, sad, different than usual, check in. If Sam's suggestions don't resonate with you, say what you wish someone would say to you if the roles were reversed. Even just, hey, if you need to talk to someone, I'm here.
I think that folks have a lot of hesitation around having these conversations, and it's understandable hesitation because these aren't conversations that we naturally are taught to have or encouraged to have. But I think what gives me a lot of hope is that we get to decide and create what's normal. So if more of us are willing to reach out in this way, and more of us are normalizing, engaging in this way, we are actively creating a world where that becomes more acceptable and that becomes more normal to do. So I try to remind people as often as possible that even if checking in this way doesn't come naturally to you, and even if it feels kind of weird, you are kind of becoming the role model, the possibility model for how we can cultivate these relationships with people and how we can support each other. And the more of us that become willing to do that, the safer people will be and the more supported people will be, which I think is ultimately what everybody would want.
So Terry, there's just nothing I don't love about what Sam says about all of this. The things that stand out to me, you know, just even thinking about the previous three episodes plus this one, is that importance of checking in and doing it before someone asks. Definitely respond when they do ask. But then also this other piece that Sam mentioned this time, which is after you think they're better.
Yes.
You know, not making the assumption that since they're no longer asking for help or support, or at least in some ways they seem like they were doing better than when you were concerned, you don't want to just drop the ball there. You know, you just want to kind of continue it through and normalize, you know, telling somebody, you seem like you're doing better on the outside. I just want to check and see how things are on the inside for you.
Mm-hmm. The metaphor that's coming to mind as you say that is like after a funeral, right? Everybody.
Yes.
Everybody walks away as if somehow that service is the end of anything for that person. And it's actually the beginning, because now the casserole stop and the people calling stops and, you know, they're alone. So it's the same thing, that after something dark and bad and scary and, you know, all the losses that come, we're all of a sudden supposed to just bounce back and be cool. And, you know, it's like, no, they still, we still need to know you still care.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, this happens, of course, you know, when people are, like you said, kind of recovering after the funeral and trying to get on, you know, with their life that's been completely changed. And they just notice everyone else is kind of going about life as usual. And I think that that is so easy to happen. I mean, life is so busy and demanding of all of us. So I guess I wouldn't trust myself to remember, hey, you need to keep checking in with this person. I could easily have that intention and forget to follow up because life. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things that, you know, put it on your calendar, put a little notation, something that just doesn't allow your life to kind of keep going on as normal when somebody that you really care about, maybe you don't even interact with them daily, but you'll want to remember them. You'll want to be able to like make good on your promise that you're going to keep checking in and figure it out together, and that you're in it for the long haul. It's like the intention can absolutely be there. The feeling can be there. And the follow through part, though, is literally like a scheduling detail thing. Don't forget to check in with so-and-so. You can set your own alarms to do that or put that in your schedule. And that doesn't make it like this, like a thing that you check off your to-do list. It doesn't in any way minimize the importance. In fact, I think the fact that you add it to what you want to do that day or that week or that month, I think it actually says, this is really important. This is really important to me. I don't want to forget this.
Mm-hmm. Two other things I want to sort of call out from this episode. One is that Sam said the idea in terms of a helping thing you can offer is to help them navigate the mental health care system. And it is hard. And,
oh, yes.
And, you know, just the idea of someone saying, I will help you find you know, a blank, whether it's a, you know, a treatment facility, whether it's a therapist, if you don't already have one, or I will make that call with or for you and make an appointment and drive you there. Those things can really very definitely be the difference between you getting that kind of care and you not getting it. So that is something I definitely wanted to call out. Sorry for the page turn there. And the other was the comment, I'm not here to judge you. I just want to figure out how to keep you safe.
Mm.
And I just can't even imagine how rarely that phrase is heard.
Mm-hmm. This whole series just sort of calls attention to the fact that as well as we are taught to do many, many things, you know, throughout life, knowing how to be there for someone who's struggling and needs support is not one of those skill sets that we're really taught. You're lucky if you've seen it modeled, you know, in your family or, you know, your friend group, but chances are this is not a skill set that you're just walking around with. There's very few people who have it. So that's the first thing is that you don't want to, we don't want to shame anybody for not knowing how to help and be supportive. I don't think we've got great models or instructions out there that we see repeatedly. Mm-hmm. That's one of the important reasons for the podcast. But I think just recognizing this is something that if you can add this to what you're good at, it will improve your life and the lives of everyone you come into contact with, because everybody at some point in time is going to struggle with something.
Absolutely.
It's just the human condition. So for us to really learn how to observe and know and approach and be there in really supportive ways when people are struggling just makes everything better, makes the world a better place. You're going to feel less incompetent or anxious or scared about how to do that. And the person on the receiving end is going to be so grateful and so happy that you did know this language. You did know the things to say. You knew the things not to say. It's so important.
Perfect way to wrap this series up. So I want to thank you. And thanks again and again to Sam Dylan Finch for his advocacy and for sharing his gift for explaining things in very clear and practical ways.
Thank you so much, Sam.
We truly hope that our podcast brings a little more understanding, helps you better articulate and reflect on your own experience with depression, or better understand how to support someone else who is struggling.
If this episode has been of comfort or value to you, know that there are hundreds of others like it in our archive, which you can easily find at our website, givingvoicetodepression.com. And remember, if you're struggling, speak up, even if it's hard. If someone else is struggling, take the time to listen.